more to halt the spread of extremist ideas, something that is becoming a greater commercial concern as advertisers pull their spending from platforms like Google and Facebook out of worry their ads will appear next to extremist content and fake news. For too long, their business models have benefited from the fact that provocative content of all kinds is often more seductive and popular than the bland and virtuous. As one promising response to the problem of extreme content, Google's think tank, Jigsaw, launched something called the redirect method, which serves potential recruits video testimonials from credible voices and other content designed to dissuade them when they search for a range of keywords typically used by wannabe ISIS members. The United States and its allies need a decentralized social media army of credible figures, moderate Muslims and others, who probably aren't going to be big fans of US foreign policy, who can make a convincing peer-to-peer case for a different path. In a new power world, this battle of ideas is not a standoff between bureaucrats and terrorists. It is a showdown between Scottish teenagers and Pakistani business students. The future will be won by those who can spread their ideas better, faster, and more durably. In a world of fake news, climate change deniers, Holocaust deniers, anti-vaxxers, and all manner of extremists, the stakes are high. Those on the side of the angels who want to spread compassion, promote pluralism, or defend science must first grapple with a painful reality: that new power can supercharge hate and misinformation. In fact, those darker forces often start at an advantage because their provocations compel our attention and our clicks. It isn't enough to simply have the facts on your side. Truth needs ace. Chapter 4. How to Build a Crowd. The protest begins with an ethnically diverse crowd of the most well-styled, shabby-chic young people you have ever seen. They march down the street smiling, pumping their fists in the air, holding up signs with the oddly generic message, "Join the conversation." As things unfold, you can see people around them going on with their lives. A pair of women are brunching. A cellist practices in an industrial-looking space. A young woman wearing a hijab looks like she is struggling with a photography project. And there is Kendall Jenner, reality star and member of the Kardashian clan, pouting at a fashion shoot. An anthem by Bob Marley's son, Skip, blares in the background. "We are the movement, this generation." You notice that everyone has something else in common. They are all drinking Pepsi. You may already know what happens next. The cellist, the young Muslim photographer, and Jenna herself join the crowd. Kendall rips off her blonde wig in an attempt at solidarity and approaches a line of stern-looking police officers. Anointing herself the leader of the protest, Jenna, a very attractive white woman, courageously walks toward an equally attractive white male police officer and hands him a Pepsi. The officer takes the Pepsi, cracks a smile in return, and the threat of violence is lifted. The protesters erupt in jubilation. This ad for Pepsi was an epic debacle. With the Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-Trump resistance in full swing in early 2017, Pepsi clumsily stole from the cultural zeitgeist. This did inspire a movement. It unified all sides of the political spectrum against Pepsi. As New York Magazine put it, Pepsi's Kendall Jenner ad sparks mass mobilization of mean, funny tweets. Under huge pressure, Pepsi pulled the spot and, rather oddly, apologized to Kendall Jenner. The Pepsi ad spoke to a world where movements are proliferating and going mainstream. Having a connected and passionate crowd on your side has become a crucial asset, whether you're trying to get a law changed, or an app launched, or just trying to sell soda. Movements, both real and Pepsi real, are popping up everywhere, originated by brands, organizations, and even teenagers who run multi-million person communities from their bedrooms. In this chapter, we explore how crowds are built in a new power world, and share the most important lessons we've learned as movement builders. We start by going back in time a little to look at one of the first movements Jeremy ever helped create. The story of Get Up. It was late 2004. John Howard, the Prime Minister, who had run Australia since the mid-1990s, had just been elected to a fourth term in office. Many Australians, including Jeremy, were despondent. Howard had led Australia into the Iraq War, refused to apologise for the historic injustices committed against Australia's Indigenous people, and championed a policy that led to thousands of refugees, including children, being locked up in desert prisons. Not everyone shared Jeremy's view. Howard appealed to a strong traditionalist and nativist strand in Australian culture and was a very savvy politician. After four straight election victories, the pundits said he was unbeatable. The opposition Labour Party was in disarray, and the many people who felt ill at ease with Howard's 1950s-era white bread vision of Australia were at the point of giving up. One day, just after Christmas, Jeremy sat on Sydney's Bondi Beach with his friend David Madden and struck up a plan. David and Jeremy had been to graduate school together at the Harvard Kennedy School and had just returned from a year in the United States volunteering on a campaign against the Iraq War. During that year, they'd begun to experiment with the kinds of new power tools like digital activism and crowdfunding that would come to transform politics in the United States. They had both taken part in big protests in Australia over the years, such as joining hundreds of thousands walking across Sydney's iconic Harbour Bridge, calling for reconciliation with Australia's Indigenous people. Yet for all the energy of these moments, people went home and things tended to pretty quickly go back to normal. The big organising challenge was not just to rally people for a single passionate protest, but to find a way to channel that passion again and again. This was an ambitious goal for two people in their 20s who had never been members of any political party and had no formal political connections, but they had the great advantage of being too young to know any better. So in August of 2005, Jeremy and David, together with their friend Amanda Tattersall, who had helped to introduce the idea to existing progressive and Labour groups, launched Get Up, an effort to bring participation back into democracy. They made a TV ad boldly declaring that Australians were starting a movement, though at this point the movement was little more than Jeremy's older sister and his 7-year-old niece, the stars of the ad. But from the start, they believed that Australians would rise up if given a little more hope and a lot more agency. Jeremy's sister's big line in the commercial summed up the behaviour they hoped to inspire. "I'm not going to give up. I'm going to get up." Get Up's launch asked people to take a simple action. Write online to your politicians. Its online tool, at the time something of a novelty, made it easy for ordinary Australians to email their representatives, easier than sending snail mail, which at the time was the primary way people could contact their representatives. It even helped people who did not know who their representatives were to find them easily, removing an important point of delay. The response was extraordinary. Within days, tens of thousands of Australians used the tool to write to their representatives about the issues they cared about and join Get Up. But what happened next was even more important. The Howard government and its allies in Australia's Rupert Murdoch-owned newspapers freaked out. Andrew Robb, a key government politician, appeared on national television to condemn the campaign. "There are hundreds of emails arriving in senators' offices. They're beside themselves just to clear the screen," he said. "This is highly irresponsible. This is spam. This is spam." If you know anything about Australians, you will know that being told that their personal messages to their elected representatives were spam was not likely to delight them. And it got worse. The government actually launched multiple investigations into Get Up to try to shut it down, referring it to the Electoral Commission and even, improbably, to the antitrust authorities. All this pushback, ironically, supercharged Get Up's credibility. People started to believe that the organisation might actually be a threat to the established political order. Online donations surged. New members flooded in. A movement was born. GetUp would go on to play a part in delivering what just 2 years before had been a very unexpected outcome. By the time of the 2007 federal election, the movement was already so big that its membership had thousands of members in John Howard's own electoral constituency. When the votes for Parliament were counted, not only did Howard's government lose power, he was the first sitting Prime Minister in almost 100 years to lose his seat in Parliament. Thanks to a campaign masterminded by GetUp's first executive director, Brett Solomon, GetUp members volunteered in unprecedented numbers in Howard's electorate district, knocking on doors and making the case for change, making 187,000 voter contacts in the lead-up to and on Election Day. The movement for progressive politics in Australia had been born again. In the years since it was launched, GetUp has influenced the outcome of several additional key elections, won a landmark ruling in Australia's highest court that established new constitutional voting rights, and helped to pass legislation protecting refugees and the environment. It has raised tens of millions of dollars in small donations from its members to fund its work. It's been described as probably Australia's most important civil society actor. Lamenting the disruptive impact the organisation has had on the established political order, the Conservative commentator Nick Cater wrote that GetUp is to politics what Uber is to taxis. Today, GetUp is the largest political organisation in Australia, with more members than all of the country's political parties put together. From its start with two young people on a beach, now more than 1 million Australians call themselves GetUp members. The five steps to building a new power crowd. GetUp is a study in how to build a crowd in a new power world, and how to sustain that power for more than a decade. When GetUp launched, it was an early experiment in digital activism. Today, the tools and tactics available to movement builders have expanded hugely. At the same time, it has become harder to break through because these days everyone is trying to rally some kind of crowd. Whether you're working to get elected to your local school board, launch an online community, or just trying to build buzz around your new business, these are the five key steps to starting and growing a flourishing movement today. Step 1. Find your connected connectors. In the early days of GetUp, Jeremy and his colleagues weren't trying to rally everyone. They were laser-focused on a group with a very specific worldview. People who were compassionate and concerned about fairness, and who had a less individualistic view of society and the economy. They were educated, skewed female, and often baby boomers. GetUp designed campaigns that, time and again, hit the hot-button issues for this group, from protecting their beloved public broadcast network from funding cuts, to advocating for refugees, to taking action on climate change. While on their face these issues were disconnected, GetUp understood there was a high chance that someone who was concerned about climate change also cared about public broadcasting. This group wasn't just philosophically connected. It was socially connected, clustered in big cities filled with urban professionals. With every early campaign GetUp ran, supporters would be encouraged to tell a friend, and that person would turn into a recruiter, bringing their own similarly minded contacts into the community. Once GetUp got off the ground, it widened its focus to include a much more diverse range of constituents, especially in terms of rural representation. Yet its initial energy relied on a very specific and passionate slice of society who spread its message sideways to hundreds of thousands of Australians. Think of this group as the connected connectors, those people who share a worldview, are networked to one another, and are influential in their reach. For any new power movement, identifying and cultivating the right connected connectors is often the difference between takeoff and fizzle. To take a very different example, in 2016, Donald Trump's connected connectors were an overlapping cadre of online activists and meme creators associated with the so-called alt-right, plus the vestiges of the Tea Party and gun rights diehards. This committed base was the catalyst for his crowd-building when he ran for president. They shared a broad set of passionate beliefs and were highly connected on message boards and platforms like Reddit and 4chan. They proved extremely effective at spreading messages and memes digitally, disseminating buzz about Trump and often false rumors or negative information about Hillary Clinton. Etsy too owes its early growth to a core of connected users. The online crafting marketplace now has tens of millions of members and generates hundreds of millions of dollars each year. Yet it only got off the ground thanks to small groups of digitally savvy feminist crafters. The platform was founded in Brooklyn in 2005 by four men. One of them, Rob Kalin, was a quintessential maker and wanted a market to sell his crafty, wood-covered computers. He wasn't alone. In the early 2000s, there was a resurgence of enthusiasm for DIY artisanship expressed online on blogging platforms like LiveJournal and offline at venues like artisan flea markets in culturally progressive cities. Some of the most passionate members of this community were women with a feminist outlook, opposed to mass-produced corporate capitalism, and looking to forge new kinds of social and economic activity, explained Morgan Brown in his definitive account of Etsy's rise. So the early Etsy team deliberately recruited the most influential crafters at flea markets in Brooklyn and elsewhere and promised them a place to sell their wares online. Critically, Etsy also provided moderated community forums on its website that allowed these crafters, who already shared a world view and had offline connections to one another, to find one another there. Brown cites a blog post from early 2008 that sums up Etsy's efforts to appeal to community. Etsy's core mission is to help artists and crafters make a living from what they make. This may seem like an innocuous enough statement, but truth be told, the socio-political, cultural, economic state in which we live makes this a rather bold rallying cry. We want to make history's way of doing things undergo a change. Etsy is part of a larger movement, and we at Etsy want to learn more about the consciousness of feminist crafters in our midst. This is most definitely not the kind of language you would have heard at the time from Amazon or eBay. Etsy had found its connected connectors. These women fueled Etsy's growth organically. There was a virtuous cycle between feminist crafters promoting Etsy as a platform and promoting their own wares online. New power was Etsy's sales and marketing engine. Step 2. Build a new power brand. Every company or institution must make key early decisions about how it will project outward into the world. It has to come up with a name and settle on a visual aesthetic and maybe some iconography. It needs to refine a voice for how it speaks to consumers or clients. These things define its brand, the way a product or organization looks, sounds, and feels in the world. The same questions are vitally important when launching a new power community, but the building blocks of a new power brand are very different from those of a purely commercial or transactional brand or a top-down organizational one. Think of an Amex Black Card or a Bentley, which project luxury and exclusivity, or the seal of the President of the United States, which is designed to project authority, pomp, and prestige. None of these gives an ordinary person any agency. But if you are designing to inspire participation, not simply drive consumption, admiration, or fear, there is a different task at hand. The GetUp brand was designed with new power instincts in mind. The name itself invoked the ability of everyday people to stop complaining and start reclaiming their own power. At the heart of its promise was an exhortation for people to act. Bright orange was chosen as the brand color, and an exclamation mark was slapped after Get Up in the logo to make it feel more like a call to action. Noting, of course, that adding an exclamation mark to the end of your logo does not a successful movement make, as Jeb exclamation mark Bush can tell you. The language of Get Up shared that spirit of group action. The About Us section of the website was not written in the voice of an organisation talking to its supporters or subjects, but in the voice of the members. The team thought of the GetUp brand less as an organisation and more as an individual with a consistent and distinctive personality, a compassionate, smart, idealistic, but not too earnest person. They also thought about who this person wasn't. A political hack, a know-it-all, an angry fringe-dwelling ideologue. When the team noticed people showing up to GetUp protests with their dogs dressed in bright orange GetUp t-shirts, and when the phrase, "I am GetUp," surfaced on social media, it was clear that the identity and voice of GetUp had aligned with, in fact, had merged with, the identity of its members. As we have said, one of the key signs that you have launched a successful movement is that it starts moving without you. These ideas don't just apply to political movements. Airbnb's brand is based on similar principles. When it emerged in 2008, its young founders, Brian Chesky, Joe Gebbia, and Nathan Blacharczyk, weren't thinking much about new power. They just wanted to find a way to pay the rent on their San Francisco apartment. But as the company grew, it did so less like a franchise, with every room looking the same, and more like a movement, with early users sharing a passion for a new kind of stay. One that provided instant community in a new place, a host to guide them in a new city, a real person to have a cup of tea with before bed. In 2014, 8 years later, Airbnb had grown exponentially, and it had in many ways moved beyond its earlier, more intimate, homemade feel. But its founders wanted to ensure that the brand remained connected to that original experience. They needed to maintain that critical point of difference from checking in and out of a Best Western. Losing the communal and community spirit of their early days was a real business threat. And there was another threat too. The regulatory challenges to Airbnb that were popping up in cities all over the world. Airbnb had begun to rally its hosts as a way of fighting back against city governments, which made users' bond with the platform even more critical. So Airbnb relaunched its brand with a brand story made for the age of new power. Douglas Atkin, an Airbnb executive with the unusual corporate title, Global Head of Community, summed it up as creating a world where anyone can belong anywhere. Airbnb's new logo was not designed to be admired, but to be remixed and adapted by different affinity groups within the Airbnb community. The soft, malleable, inverted heart, or pretzel, depending on your perspective, drew a level of online engagement perhaps best summed up by Fast Company's headline, "This Tumblr shows everything Airbnb's new logo looks like, in addition to a vagina." Airbnb even introduced a tool called Create to make it easier to remix the logo and make it more meaningful for a host's own purposes. "Most brands would send you a cease and desist letter if you tried to recreate their brand," said Airbnb's CEO, Brian Chesky, when the identity was launched. "We wanted to do the opposite." The Create tool was a little gimmicky, no doubt, but it signalled the way Airbnb saw its community. As a place where you could both belong and be yourself. That's consistent with Marilyn Brewer's behavioural science concept of optimal distinctiveness, which suggests that the right recipe for building an effective group is making people feel like they are part of it and that they can stand out in it. Along with the new logo, Airbnb retooled its corporate language with a manifesto more like that of an alternative living community than a Silicon Valley money machine. "We used to take belonging for granted. Cities used to be villages. Everyone knew each other and everyone knew they had a place to call home. But after the mechanization and industrial revolution of the last century, those feelings of trust and belonging were displaced by mass-produced and impersonal travel experiences. We also stopped trusting each other, and in doing so, we lost something essential about what it means to be a community. That's why Airbnb is returning us to a place where everyone can feel they belong. At a time when new technologies have made it easier to keep each other at a distance, you're using them to bring people together. Belonging is the idea that defines Airbnb, but the way we've represented Airbnb to the world until now hasn't fully captured this." Contrast this to the classic old power queues in the About Hilton section of the Hilton Hotel website. Take me to the Hilton. As the most recognized name in the industry, travelers all over the world have been saying, take me to the Hilton, for almost a century. And because of our innovative approach to products, amenities and service, Hilton continues to be synonymous with hotel across the globe. Hilton Hotels and Resorts remains the stylish, forward-thinking global leader of hospitality, and we help make traveling easier with our smart design, innovative restaurant concepts, authentic hospitality, and commitment to the global community. Airbnb's brand voice is built to cultivate a sense of community and participation, and executives are betting that this will be a key source of competitive advantage, because it makes it far less likely that Airbnb hosts or guests will move to the next platform when one emerges. Airbnb now spends millions holding an annual gathering of thousands of its most active hosts, building solidarity and esprit de corps the way a church or rotary club might. Going further, it has invested in supporting local groups of hosts as part of a decentralized home-sharing club, supported by Airbnb, but led by its most involved members. Meanwhile, Hilton relies on the value proposition that has sustained it for decades. Its biggest claim is that its brand is recognized. It sees its advantage in admiration, not activation. Its value proposition offers style, rather than a sense of belonging. In a new power world, Hilton knows it must tip its hat to a global community. But that feels very much like an afterthought. The ownerless brand. When Henry first had the idea for the philanthropic campaign Hashtag Giving Tuesday, he had some trouble convincing his colleagues at the 92nd Street Y to go along. But where is our logo? He was asked. We must have the 92Y logo between giving and Tuesday. This, Henry tried to explain, missed the point. If 92Y stuck its logo onto Hashtag Giving Tuesday, no other organization would want to take part. It would be a popular idea in their local ecosystem, but could not grow any further. If they really wanted this initiative to spread, Henry argued, 92Y couldn't own it. Instead of 92Y's logo, there was a simple heart between giving and Tuesday. The mission of the overall campaign had to be valued over the positioning of 92Y as an institution. Old power brands created by big organizations are typically accompanied by strict rules. Use Pantone color 7507C. Use this version of the logo here and that version there. Make sure it's reproduced at least this size, lest anyone miss it. They are steeped in a franchise philosophy, not a movement one. Think how McDonald's enforces sameness. It is telling that the very concept of brand is drawn from the practice of literally stamping an indelible symbol of ownership on an asset. Yet the only reason Hashtag Giving Tuesday could grow so much is that so many could develop a meaningful stake in it. Chuck Gates, 92Y's art director, initially recoiled in horror when he saw the heart logo he had designed for the initiative being reworked, often by less talented designers, in hundreds of spin-off efforts. Canadians added a maple leaf, breast cancer charities turned it pink, and a testicular cancer charity even flipped the heart upside down. Today, however, he takes great pride in the many variations of his work, regarding it as one of his greatest achievements. For him, Hashtag Giving Tuesday had become much bigger than a logo. It was a coherent but ever-changing new power brand, generously shared among designers, amateur and professional, all over the world. It was ownerless in the sense that anyone could lay claim to it. Note that this approach does not mean that organizations should become anonymous or completely give up on PR. Yet there is a real skill, especially for old power institutions, in what Usher Curran, 92Y's chief innovation officer and leader of the Hashtag Giving Tuesday project, thinks of as unbranding, reducing the old power instinct to overwhelm campaigns or ideas with stamps of ownership, and by doing so, allowing them to travel more widely. Note too that there is real payoff to the ownerless approach. Giving Tuesday reached a scale and media profile that would have been inconceivable had it been positioned as 92Y's campaign. It repositioned the 144-year-old institution too, earning it a spot on Fast Company's Most Innovative Company list and helping secure a $15 million gift to name its Belfer Center for Innovation and Social Impact. Step 3. Lower the barrier, flatten the path. In the 20th century, participating in politics or social change could feel like a test of will. To join a political party, you'd often have to pledge your loyalty and support for a long list of policies, some of which you might not actually agree with. To participate, you'd have to show up to procedural meetings at your local branch, where your most exciting moment might be seconding the motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting. And for this privilege, you literally paid your dues, up front and then at some regular interval. If you were an activist, credibility came from how much you laid on the line. The heroes were the people who put their bodies in physical jeopardy for the cause. In the early environmental movement, you protested logging by chaining yourself to a tree. These weren't easy things to do, especially if you lived far away from the locus of action, or were a not-so-limber grandparent, or just wanted to do your bit without doing anything too extreme. And this meant that many movements tended not to scale beyond small, often more radical groups of activists. Those who did succeed in building a mass space, like the US Civil Rights Movement, drew on a big existing infrastructure, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did with black churches. But the new power era has promoted a form of activism that can be scaled much more quickly than a 20th century movement, and can be initiated by almost anyone, including those without a formal apparatus or an existing bully pulpit. These movements can more easily include wider groups of people, including those who previously had been left on the sidelines or couldn't easily participate. This dynamic has not just been playing out in the activism space. A macro theme of our age is that participating in almost anything has become easier, whether we're protesting, taking vacations, or even managing our dating lives. The dating app Tinder famously has reduced the transaction costs associated with finding a date to a series of brutally efficient left or right swipes. To join, you don't even need to create a profile. Tinder can scrape together our existing Facebook profile info and pictures to make one for us, so that we can get to judging and being judged right away. What is common among all these things is that we are seeing the barriers to participation lowered and a heightened focus on improving and streamlining user experiences. In a world awash with competing opportunities in which to take part, achieving frictionlessness, removing the barriers to action and engagement, has become the necessary art of anyone trying to build a crowd. The single most important factor behind the early success of GetUp was how easy it was for people, frantic, information overloaded, but well-intentioned 21st century people, to participate. No member dues, no pledges of allegiance to a platform, no immediate requirement to take to the streets. Rather, GetUp asked people on joining to sign a single online petition on just one issue they cared about. GetUp's organizers were relentlessly focused on the how of this, how they could remove all obstacles to signing a petition, how long a petition landing page took to load, how much information they should ask for on sign-up, name, email, zip code. This approach horrified some more traditional groups. Wouldn't making it so easy to join just attract the weak-willed and the riffraff? Their sign-up forms required much more upfront information, and so by the time people worked their way through them, attrition rates were high. GetUp's mantra, which is also that of Silicon Valley, was to make it as easy as possible to get in the door. In doing so, the dynamic between organizer and participant was flipped. The onus was on GetUp to provide its members meaningful opportunities to increase their engagement, not on members to prove their undying commitment to the cause. An unlikely digital wunderkind has used the same basic logic to produce an enormous surge of new power. Indian anti-corruption activist Kisan Anna Baburao Hazare is 80. He doesn't wear a hoodie. For decades, he has campaigned for social justice in the Gandhian tradition, non-violent protest driven by acts of personal sacrifice, such as fasts unto death, to protest corrupt officials and unjust laws. In other words, for most of his career, he has operated in the classic activist tradition, by doing things most of us would never have the courage or initiative to do. In 2011, Hazare was staging his biggest campaign yet in support of what became known as the Jan Lakpal legislation, a national anti-corruption bill that would strengthen the power of ombudsmen to hold public officials accountable at all levels of government from the Prime Minister on down. His campaign was striking a chord with ordinary Indians who were fed up with the small and large acts of everyday corruption that chip away at the trust between people and public institutions. In early April 2011, after the Prime Minister rejected his demands, Hazare announced he was beginning a fast until the Jan Lakpal bill was passed. Hunger strikes are a very powerful tactic, especially given their legacy in India. They carry with them enormous moral authority, and the human drama involved tends to attract media attention, vital oxygen in any campaign against powerful interests. But there's a weakness to hunger strikes also. They don't give other people anything to do except express support. At least not unless you're willing to do the same. If the job of an activist is to feed the agency of his supporters, Hazare knew he needed to do more. Hazare began to experiment with new tactics. He asked Indians to send him an SMS if they supported his campaign. Most Indians have a mobile phone, and among the emerging middle class, who formed the backbone of Hazare's supporter base, mobile penetration was near universal. So Hazare got himself a short code and generated about 80,000 texts from ordinary Indians, a respectable effort. Then Hazare subtly changed his tactics. All over India, and in many other parts of the developing world, people use missed calls to communicate with each other. If you're running late for a coffee with a friend, you leave them a missed call. If you're dating someone and just want to let them know you're thinking about them, you leave a missed call. Yes, that's right. In some cultures, the way to show your lover you care is by hanging up on them. Why do people leave missed calls? Because unlike phoning or texting someone, it's free. It's also effortless. This small change in tactics made a spectacular difference. When Hazare provided a local number to call and asked Indians to show their support for his campaign against corruption, his numbers went from 80,000 to 35 million. 35 million missed calls. That's one of the largest single coordinated acts of protest in human history. We've yet to find a bigger one. How did it happen? The ubiquity of the mobile phone is obviously key. 10 years earlier, such a campaign would have been impossible. It was also an extraordinary show of strength for India's emerging middle class. And it's a great example of how to build a crowd in a new power way. And central to it was using an existing behaviour, the missed call, which everyone was already doing, and by making the barrier to participation low. Taking part was truly frictionless. Step 4. Move people up the participation scale. You might ask, so what? What do 35 million calls really add up to? Isn't this just clicktivism? Malcolm Gladwell wrote a long missive in The New Yorker to this end, arguing that online activism makes it so easy to participate that it all ends up being based on weak ties, unlike strong ties activism, where people put their lives on the line and form deep face-to-face relationships with each other. In one sense, Gladwell is right. Commitment matters. As we'll explore in the next chapter, the super participants in any movement or new power community do some of its most important work. But this new capacity to get many more people in the door comes with incredible opportunities for impact, as Hazare discovered. For Hazare, a mass base of support mattered a great deal. First, those huge numbers delivered tremendous moral legitimacy. These were just too many people for the government to ignore. Even more important, Hazare turned those phone numbers into real, on-the-ground power. 2 weeks after making this call to action, Azari's campaign had the world's largest spreadsheet of phone numbers of supporters. What next? Azari's then campaign contacted people on his list to help turn out hundreds of thousands of people to real-world protests in Delhi and other cities. It was an extraordinary display of mobile to offline power. And while Azari's bill didn't pass as is, the government did accept a number of his demands. His 2011 campaign helped to push through sweeping changes to India's laws against corruption. 4/The Rules, a group focused on empowering citizens in the Global South incubated by Purpose, the organization Jeremy leads, then built a piece of technology to help others do what Azari did. A tool called 4/CrowdRing that allows campaigners in other countries to create their own missed calls campaigns. Gladwell's critique of low-barrier activism makes little sense if movement builders know how to move people from more superficial to more robust forms of engagement, as Azari was able to do. This still is baked into what we call the participation scale. On the low end of the scale are the definitive old power behaviors, complying and consuming. Most old power models don't require much more of us than this. File your taxes, buy these shoes, renew your subscription. Of course, neither compliance nor consumption is going out of vogue anytime soon. Many of our most important social and economic institutions still mostly run on them. The participation scale. Old power behaviors, complying, traditional compliance. Consuming, traditional consumption. New power behaviors. Sharing, sharing other people's content or ideas. Affiliating, endorsing or joining a new power community. Adapting, remixing other people's content or ideas. Funding, affiliating with money within a new power community. Producing, creating or delivering content or assets within a new power community. Shaping. Shaping or protecting the norms of a new power community. But if you're trying to build a movement or grow a crowd, you'll need to unlock a series of new power behaviors. You get people in the door via simple, low-barrier asks toward the bottom of the scale. For instance, by asking people to consume and then share content. Or by affiliating. In get-up terms, by signing your first petition. Once you have recruited these new participants, the job is to keep them engaged and to move people up the scale toward higher barrier behaviors, like adapting or remixing the content of others, crowdfunding a project, creating and uploading their own unique content or assets, we call this producing, or, at the top of the scale, by becoming a shaper of the community as a whole, with the capacity to influence the strategy, norms and culture of a crowd, often without having any kind of formal authority. Think here of the Airbnb superhosts, who set norms for others on the platform, the significant but informal role played by the Black Lives Matter founders, or the most influential volunteer moderators on Reddit, whom we will learn more about in the following chapter. TED, the conference community, is adept at moving its users up the participation scale. To get people in the door, TED asks us to view, consume, its most compelling TED Talks, drawn from its official conferences and TEDx, its locally organized conferences. It then encourages us to share those talks, and even offers viewers a tracker to help them see how many people they've reached by sharing, a clever way to increase our sense of agency. Moving up the scale, we are asked to join the TED community and affiliate in a variety of ways. For example, by nominating someone for the TED Prize. In doing so, we are encouraged to think of ourselves as TEDsters, a branding device to help create shared identity. TEDsters have an opportunity to adapt TED's original content by joining its army of volunteer translators who interpret the business jargon and pop science that TED is best known for into their own languages. Moving further up, TEDsters are given a range of ways they can fund TED's work, including by attending TED's high-priced official conferences or the much more accessible TEDx events. Finally, TEDsters are able to become producers by organizing their own TEDx conferences or giving their own TEDx talks. There have now been over 20,000 events organised around the world, from Madrid to Manchester. The most committed and active TEDx organisers become shapers of that community, helping to steer its direction at global gatherings convened by TED. Only a tiny fraction of TEDsters move all the way up the participation scale from consuming its content to become TEDx superorganizers. But providing this path makes it possible for TED to move people from content consumers and fans into more valuable roles, like funder or organizer. Having a structure in place to move people up the participation scale is critical, even in the early stages of building a new power community. Perhaps the most inane example of a failure to do this was the social networking app Yo, launched in 2014 by an Israeli software developer as an April Fool's joke with just one incredibly low-barrier feature. You tapped once, and the word Yo would be automatically sent to a friend in your contact list. Your friend could then Yo back if he or she so chose. Inevitably, the app captured the imagination of the internet. By mid-June, the app was the number one social networking app in the Apple App Store, and number four overall. The app raised seven figures in venture capital, to the bewilderment of many. Tech blogger Robert Scoble described Yo as the stupidest, most addictive app I've ever seen in my life. But addictiveness wasn't enough. Yo became a revolving door for users. By September, just a few months after launch, it was down to number 1,277 in the App Store. The app's developers used their venture capital money to try to define a path up the participation scale beyond Yoing, such as adding location and photos with your Yo and creating groups to make the app more social. But because those steps weren't in place during Yo's initial surge, the opportunity passed to build on that early virality. Today's most cutting-edge activists understand both how to create frictionless entry points and move people up the participation scale. Black Lives Matter has built the most effective movement for racial justice since the civil rights movement by combining what Gladwell would deride as weak ties activism. Very simple forms of affiliation and sharing like hashtags that have rapidly spread its message, with more committed actions all the way up the participation scale, from funding like-minded activist groups to producing real-world protests and setting up local chapters. Step 5. Harness the three storms. The American civic leader John W. Gardner believed that civilization is a drama lived in the minds of a people. His insight helps us in thinking about how new power communities and movements grow. A secret of the most successful movements is that they build up not just in small, steady increments, but off the backs of galvanizing moments of drama and urgency that can be hard to predict. The Women's March on Washington the day after Trump's inauguration has become an iconic example of a wave of new power that built in the wake of a historic disappointment, the failure to elect the first woman president, and the election of a man with a long track record of sexist remarks and behavior. When growing a crowd, good organizers take advantage of such moments. Sometimes those moments happen to them, and their job is to embrace them, even if at first they seem like setbacks, not opportunities. Sometimes they see a moment out in the world and use it to fuel a movement. And at other times, they create a moment out of thin air. We think of this as harnessing the three storms.
Storm creating. Beatrice Ehlers was a student in the Friedenreich, a municipal school rated as one of the top 10 schools in Rio. The Friedenreich was known for serving disadvantaged karaokes, the term used by the proud citizens of Rio to describe themselves, including many young people with disabilities. Like many community spaces in Rio, the school had been condemned with little warning and marked for imminent demolition to make way for Olympic development, in this case, to build a deeply uninspiring parking lot. Young Bia, as she was known, desperately wanted to save her school. So she used an online tool called Panela Je Presso, pressure cooker, that allows karaokes to start campaigns on issues that matter to them right from their phones. The insight behind Panela Je Presso was that in order to have any chance of participating in government effectively, citizens needed a way to figure out the right decision maker to target, then to join with others to put pressure on that person. The tool was a product of Meu Rio, an anti-corruption and civic participation group in Rio, incubated at Jeremy's organisation Purpose, and the brainchild of a brilliant young woman from Rio, Alessandra Orofino. More than 1 in 10 millennial-aged cariocas are now members of Meu Rio, and the group is part of a wave of bottom-up protest and civic engagement that is reshaping Brazil's atrophied politics. When Bia started her campaign, it struck a chord with Meu Rio. How could such a precious school be demolished so cavalierly, they asked. When they saw the early traction that the girls' campaign was getting, they decided to try to turn her fight into what movement builders call an iconic impact story. So Alessandra and her team did something dramatic, even theatrical. They set up a website with a 24-hour live video stream of the school and asked cariocas to monitor the feed around the clock for signs of bulldozers and other demolition equipment arriving, which was expected any day. Meu Rio then asked people to sign up to become citizen guardians of the school by registering their mobile phone numbers with the site, and to ask their friends and neighbours to do the same. As soon as the bulldozers arrived, the citizen guardians would be urged by text to rush to the school to form a human barrier to protect it, forming a circle of defiance. The campaign captured the imagination of the city. Thousands of people signed up to protect the school, and a huge wave of media coverage followed. Suddenly, some serious heat was directed at the decision maker with the ultimate power to save the school, the governor of Rio, who had, until then, been able to ignore the pleas of a few students, teachers, and parents in a disadvantaged area. Within 72 hours of the launch of the live stream, the governor had a rather remarkable change of heart. He decided to cancel the demolition until a new school could be built. And after 6 more months of persistent campaigning by Meu Rio, the governor wholly capitulated. The Friedenreich would be saved. Bia had won a great victory, but perhaps, more important, a signal had been sent to Rio's politicians. The next time you try to demolish a school without consulting the community, people will hold you accountable and will capture every moment on camera. This little victory also triggered a larger debate in Rio about unaccountable Olympic development, one that hadn't fully broken through until Bia's moment crystallized the injustice. And by turning her story into a cultural flashpoint, Meu Rio had created a storm that built its crowd and advanced its movement. In 2010, GetUp created its own galvanizing moment in an effort to draw attention to Australia's inhumane treatment of refugees. At the Australian Parliamentary Press Gallery's annual charity dinner, dates with different politicians are auctioned off, and usually bought by corporate interest groups seeking FaceTime with elected officials. When then-opposition leader Tony Abbott, an avid surfer and fierce opponent of refugee rights, put a personal surfing lesson up for auction, GetUp decided to hijack this ritual. It asked its members to crowdfund a bid at the auction. If GetUp won, Abbott would be obliged to give a surfing lesson to Riz Wakil, a refugee who had fled Afghanistan in 1999 and endured almost a year in one of Australia's notorious immigrant detention centres. Within 3 hours, GetUp members had chipped in $50,000 and won Wakil a very public date with Abbott. It had found a way to capture the imagination of the media on a vital topic and give a cheeky win to its members. Storm chasing. Sometimes a storm is in full swing, and the job of the crowd builder is to chase it down and harness its power. That's how Reddit, the hugely popular platform where people upvote their favourite content, really took off. 5 years after its founding in 2005, Reddit was still a bit player among user-driven aggregation sites. Its much bigger sibling was Digg, where tens of millions of monthly visitors busily voted for their favourite content. In 2010, Digg announced version 4 of the site, a major upheaval that deprioritized user-made content in favor of promoting content from big online publishers like Mashable.com, and introduced sponsored links, a way to monetize the site. At around the same time, a small subset of gig users had figured out how to game the system so that the site's article recommendation features shut out content from ordinary users in favor of the group's preferred links, essentially crippling the democratic quality of the site. On August 30th, 2010, Quit Dig Day was declared by another set of users agitated by all the change, who flooded the site with content from its smaller competitor, Reddit. Reddit saw the storm and chased it brilliantly. Reddit's co-founder, Alexis Ohanian, wrote an open letter to Dig's co-founder and CEO, Kevin Rose, lamenting, with barely concealed glee, that it had strayed from its original mission of giving power back to the people. Reddit temporarily changed its logo to incorporate the Dig shovel in order to welcome its users, a superb flash of new power branding. Quickly and spectacularly, millions of users migrated from Dig to Reddit. The Great Dig Exodus killed its traffic numbers, and a business once valued at $200 million was eventually sold in a fire sale for $500,000. Reddit, as we know it, was born. In the next chapter, we'll talk about how Reddit then managed and mismanaged the crowd it built so quickly. The art of turning someone else's crisis into your opportunity is far from new, but the new skill is doing it in an age when the opportunity to mobilize a crowd comes and goes in minutes. The American cookie brand, Oreo, understood this when a power outage in the stadium caused lights to go out for more than 30 minutes during the 2013 Super Bowl. Oreo struck quickly, tweeting a picture of a lonely but well-lit Oreo and the caption, "You can still dunk in the dark." The tweet went viral, won the Super Bowl, and became the stuff of legends in marketing circles. Often left out of the story is the fact that Oreo had a 15-person social media team at the ready during the game for exactly this kind of rapid response. We don't all have Oreo's resources, but its handiwork reminds us that storm chasing requires infrastructure to do well. Anyone building a crowd should be on the lookout for storms that might galvanize their base and be prepared to act on them within minutes or hours when the need is greatest and people's emotional response is at its peak. Many old power organizations will take days just to cobble together a press release, but organizations now need to be set up to move faster, to soak up the energy in a moment and turn that into new supporters. Byzantine bureaucracies requiring multiple sign-offs aren't the right tools for storm chasing. Storm embracing. Sometimes the best way to build a crowd is to embrace the fact that a storm is at your doorstep and let yourself get swept up in it. As we discussed earlier, the torrent of attacks on GetUp from prominent politicians and the conservative media were key to GetUp's early growth. Our favorite example of storm embracing comes from an inspired group of Girl Scouts. In 2015, a donor made a $100,000 contribution to the Girl Scouts of Western Washington, targeted for financial aid to poorer scouts, but with a stipulation that the funds not be used to benefit transgender girls. The Girl Scouts felt this would be a grave injustice and essentially said, "Bring it on." They returned the funds and launched #ForEveryGirl, a crowdfunding effort to make up the difference in its budget, including aid to young transgender women. The Scouts raised $338,000, gained a big new following, and spread a powerful message of inclusivity. One of the backers captured what this campaign meant to her. "I participated in 15 years of Girl Scouting. Twice in 5 years, I've seen you stand up for trans people like me. It makes me cry and brings me such happiness that I could be part of something so amazing. So thank you so much for giving love, family, and friends to those who are just trying so hard to be true to themselves. For upholding everything I was ever taught Girl Scouts was. You are my heroes. Quinn, #ForEveryGirl supporter." Even big, risk-averse companies are recognizing the value of storm embracing, where they might once have tried to shy away from controversy. In 2017, when conservative provocateur Ann Coulter attacked Delta on social media for changing her seat on a plane, featuring an intrusive video of the woman who had been allocated the seat in her stead, the company chose to raise the stakes, responding via Twitter that her actions were